Once upon a time, in a part of America called Texas, lived a slender, rosy-cheeked girl with a joyous nature and a quick, active mind. One day, the girl grew up, and the world was charmed.
I have a place where dreams are born, and time is never planned. It's not on any chart. You must find it with your heart. Never land.
Meet Mary Martin, the documentation of a career. Another of NBC's transcribed biographies in sound. In the next 55 minutes, you will hear Oscar Hammerstein II, Joshua Logan, Vinton Friedley, Myron McCormick, Wally Westmore, and others. Your chronicler, Frank Blair. And the story begins like this. Mary, Mary, quite uncontrary, how did you grow? An extraordinarily uncomplicated woman who long ago came to terms with herself. No paradoxes, no conflicts, no inner problems.
Mary is the essence of naturalism and wholesomeness and reality. And especially if she's playing the part of an American girl, she is America.
Oscar Hammerstein II.
She's the spirit of our country, and especially, I think, of our Middle West. I have a picture of Mary when she was 15 years old. And she's in shorts, and she's carrying a jug in each hand. This is down in Texas. And she looks like a boy. She also looks very much like the same girl who sang I'm in Love with a Wonderful Guy in a pair of denim shorts much later in life.
The very picture of a pretty, genuine girl all the time. Yet, when first we meet, there's nothing to separate her from all the others. Just one more talented aspirant, unknown and virtually unheralded.
It was 1938. I was doing a play by Cole Porter called Leave It to Me.
Vinton Friedley, the producer.
We had a small part in the play for which I had engaged a rather well-known actress. She, however, just gotten married and seemed to be more interested in her marriage than in appearing on the stage. And 2 weeks before we opened in New Haven, I had to let her go. So it is up to me to find a replacement for this lady. A classmate of mine, Lawrence Schwab, happened to be in New York, and he called me up and said there's a girl he'd brought on from Hollywood that he thought I ought to hear. So I went up to a little apartment somewhere in the West 90s and was introduced to a young lady called Mary Martin. I said, well, Miss Martin, would you sing a song or two for me so I can judge the quality of your voice? So what do you suppose she did? She started to sing operatic arias for me. I said, wait a minute. This is not exactly what I want for this particular part. Have you got any other register? Can you sing in a lower register? She said, sure. I got two registers. I got the high one and I got the low one. So then she sang me something like Stormy Weather and so forth. But I saw the girl had great personality, and I thought it'd be worthwhile introducing her to Cole Porter, who was the composer of this play. So I took her down the next morning, introduced her to Bill Gaxton, Victor Moore, and the rest of the cast, Cole Porter, and immediately she won their hearts and she got the job. I thought this girl, Mary Martin, had great talent. So I spoke to Cole Porter and I said, see here, Mary's up in her dressing room most of the second act. We have to fill this spot. Can you write her a song that will incorporate the plot of the play? So Cole sat down and wrote My Heart Belongs to Daddy. It was incorporated in the opening at the Colonial Theater in Boston, and of course it became the highlight of the show.
But when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to Daddy. If I invite a boy some night to dine on my fine cinnamon patty, I just adore his asking for more, but my heart belongs to Daddy. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy, so I simply should be bad. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So if I want to warn you, Daddy, so I think you're perfectly swell, that my heart belongs to Daddy. And my daddy, he treats it
rhythm was insinuating, the voice fresh and expressive, not to mention a polite and discreet striptease. In less time than it takes to paint a star on a dressing room door, Mary Martin had become the showstopper. Theatrical columnist Rady Harris remembers the moment clearly.
I think I was one of a handful of people that night, that memorable night at the Imperial Theater 17 years ago, that knew Mary Martin personally. I mean, to the rest of the audience, she was an undiscovered talent. But I don't think any of us, even those closest to her, dreamed that she would have this absolutely fabulous success that night. I've never seen a number stop a show cold. And the next morning, she was everybody's Valentine. By the time I got backstage to her dressing room, instead of being the six forlorn friends who knew her, we were practically shunted aside in the mob scene with Elsa Maxwell and Jules Glenzer and Winthrop Rockefeller and this man in the tuxedo who kissed her on either cheek and said, "Darling, you are absolutely marvelous." And Mary turned to me and said, "Who was that?" And I said, "That was Noel Coward."
The flash and impact of an explosion. Mary was one of the few entertainers ever to achieve virtual stardom in her first one spot. Those beyond the footlights were in no position, of course, to know of the tour de force accomplished by Mary 19 years previously in a place called Weatherford. Weatherford, Texas. So small you might miss it if you winked while driving through. A sleepy place of warm, nestling homes, peach orchards, and watermelon patches. All in one tight little landscape of pastel color. From the beginning, life flowed to Mary's door, or romped in the vacant field across the way.
Mary was always pretty much of a tomboy when she was small.
Ford White, now a Texas businessman. In those days, the boy next door.
She'd always want to hang around with the rest of the boys, and we'd always go about three blocks from home. There's a hill called Oyster Hill. The kids used to like to go up there and dig in these Indian graves for trinkets and arrowheads. And usually on Saturdays, why, a group of us boys would go up there. Well, Mary always wanted to tag along. Three of us boys started up there one Saturday morning, and Mary came along and says, "I'm going too." Well, we didn't like it at all. We were just kids, and naturally we were all barefooted, and we told her that if she didn't go back home, why, we'd pick up a rock and throw it on her feet. And we did throw several practice rocks, but it didn't faze Mary at all. Finally, I picked up one that I could barely lift, and I said, "Mary, if you don't go home, I'm going to throw this rock on your foot just as sure as we're here." And she didn't go home, and sure enough, I dropped that big heavy rock on her right big toe, and to this day, there's a scar on it.
Well, the issue was obviously clear even then. There was to be an intensity about everything which Mary did. That tour de force we mentioned, it came at the age of five, when a pink-ribboned little girl stood before an audience at Fireman's Hall and made a singing debut. In an energetic, childish treble, Mary warbled "The Lilac Tree." She's under the impression that she was neither embarrassed nor aged by the experience. Life was sheltered, life was safe, and full of music.
Mrs. Preston Martin called me and asked me if I would hear her little daughter sing after a concert.
Mrs. Helen Cahoon, Mary's voice teacher, then and now.
And I said, "Well, of course, how old is she?" "Well, she's 12 years old." And I said, "Well, that's a little young." "Oh, I know, but I think she's phenomenal," said Mrs. Martin. And I heard Mary sing. She recited a little piece and danced a little thing. She had on a little midi blouse and a pleated skirt and brown hair that fell to her shoulders and these beautiful big eyes. Her voice was lovely, and we began working on various things. She did an old H. Lane Wilson spring song with little trills and so forth, and she did it extremely well. She showed aptitude, and she was very serious about it. And, of course, at that time, she was just in the early beginnings.
Mary's father, a successful lawyer and school board chairman, instilled in her a genius for making friends. But it was her mother who became the real instrument of destiny.
She did everything her mother wanted her to. She responded to all this training, dancing and elocuting and doing all the things that she had, took part in all the little school things, showing that she had the real capacity and talent.
A pure ear for music and a voice as certain as a tuning fork. A voice which someday would run an extraordinary gamut from a calliope on the loose to the softest of whispers. The real-life scenes began to unfold rapidly. At 16, Mary ran away and got married, an elopement with a hometown boy which ended in divorce 3 years later, though not before the birth of a son. But by then, she had thrust herself into a new career.
It seemed like we couldn't put on any kind of entertainment in Weatherford without having Mary either as mistress of ceremonies or having charge of the dance class.
Again, Ford White.
And just as soon as she got out of school, my boy, howdy, here she came back and opened up a dance studio. And naturally, the mothers had known Mary all their life, said, well, I want my son and daughter to take dancing from Mary because I know what she can do. And as a result, why, her classes were always filled.
Pupils from 2.5 to 65. Foxtrots, waltzes, mazurkas, splits, assemblies, time steps, all the forms of the Terpsichorean melange. Mary's dancing classes, in the recollection of her first student, Jim White, were the talk of the town.
Mary was the type that put on very professional shows. It was not just a little recital of her pupils, but the shows were of very high class, unusual for this location at that time. She had a patience and a calmness that encouraged pupils, that during our performances, she just seemed as if it were just another private lesson for us, and we never even realized there was anyone watching us. We just felt we were doing it for Mary, and Mary alone.
And Mary alone was already an enormously versatile young lady, dancer, singer, bursting with a bag full of theatrical know-how, making frequent appearances on a radio station in nearby mineral wells. Listen.
That was the Sunshine Special of Health and Happiness, bringing you to Mineral Wells, Texas. This broadcast is coming to you right from the lobby of the beautiful Crazy Hotel, the home of our great natural product, Crazy.
Real Crazy. An actual broadcast of 1930. A myriad sound waves ago, yet tonight there is one who clearly recalls. Francis Quinn, now an assistant manager at the hotel, sang on the same program.
Hearing that brought back some fond memories, and of course, bringing back fond memories includes all the people that participated in the show and on the show. One particular thing about Mary, when she first came on our radio show, Mary came on and did a number, her number, and rehearsed with us and all like that. And the organist, Frank Dinkins, I made the remark to him, that old gal, I'll be able to go somewhere. She's busy enough to at least. They dress her up in some frilly clothes, and I know our first opening date out of town, she had on this frilly blue costume, and she sang Alice Blue Gown. And she was just really wild. Actually, she was very professional from the start.
By now, Mary was thoroughly infected with the virus of the theater. Hollywood was not too far away, so she headed in that direction. But storming the celluloid citadel was anything but easy. She continued her voice lessons, though, and worked wherever she could, never in films, but sometimes in nightclubs and sometimes in radio. Big-time radio. Again, listen.
Buddy Rogers, his orchestra, and Mary Martin.
January 8, 1937, right here on NBC.
You're wonderful, you're true divine.
And when your lovely eyes look in mine, it's delightful, it's delicious, it's lovely. My heart does bump, my head does twirl.
I'll bet you tell that to all the girls, it's delightful.
It's delicious, it's lovely.
Ain't good talk like that. cause I don't know where I'm at. When you say things like that, why, buddy, tain't no good.
I'll sing you a thousand love songs like old King Solomon.
But he had a thousand wives.
And listen, baby, I'll bet he had plenty of fun.
For sentimental reasons, I think you ought to.
The soft, liquid, melodious voice and the southern manner captivated some, but failed to break through hard-crusted nightclub audiences. Until one particular day just before amateur night at the then-famous Hollywood Trocadero.
Mary said one day...
Again, Helen Cahoon.
I'm sick and tired of singing things that I had taught her. Straight, you see, il baccio. So she picks up her baccio and she does it... And right in the middle of after the first statement of the theme, she begins to swing it. And it's really something. So that night, at her opportunity night at the Trocadero, she let loose with Il Baccio. Nobody paid any attention to her until the orchestra struck up bum da dum bum bum. Then she goes in to all this thing, you see, swinging it as in her particular way of doing things. And she made a tremendous hit.
Feet tapped, tables thumped, agents, producers, and directors crowded around. Broadway beckoned, and with it, My Heart Belongs to Daddy. Almost immediately, she was spending after-theater hours singing in the Rainbow Room, her mornings making records with Eddie Duchin, and her luncheon time saying no to movie agents.
We were living at 110 West 55th Street, and we had a... penthouse there, which sounds rather elegant, but wasn't. And Mary had the small penthouse next door to us.
Marion and John Byram. Their world is the theater, too.
We were extremely fond of her. She's a darling girl, and we used to have a lot of fun. And one thing that she did was to come over and listen to the records that she had made. She was taking vocal lessons, and she liked to listen to the records to correct any mistakes. So she would come over and play the records on our machine. We saw a great deal of her that way.
Dick Halliday and I worked at Paramount together for many years, and he would come up to our apartment a good deal of time. Mary was living next door. Several occasions we tried to get Dick and Mary together.
But we Dick thought they'd make a great team.
You know, but Dick was rather an elegant young man around town, decided he wanted no part of a little girl from Texas. Somehow they never met. In our place, that is, until... Then Dick went to Hollywood as a story editor of Paramount, and Murray was signed to a Paramount contract, and they met on the lot there.
In fact, even before Hollywood was aware of any romance, that was in May of 1940, Mary and Dick Halliday eloped to Yuma, Arizona. The lure of movie land bullion kept Mary prospecting in the Hollywood Hills, and she struck a contract for 14 pictures. Now, half sprite, half siren, her charm lay in her genuineness and unpretentious attitude. That is, except for an occasional flutter. Hollywood makeup impresario Wally Westmore remembers well the day they met.
Now, on this particular day, I happened to tell Mary the story that I tell to all the new young players who come to Paramount. And I cited an instance of one of the young players who... believed all the publicity that was written about her and had gotten the big head. So Mary said, Wally, if I ever get the big head, you tell me. Well, I said, Mary, you know, sometimes the truth hurts and the people don't like it. She said, I mean it, Wally. Please tell me if I ever do. Well, after Mary had done several pictures, I walked up to her and said, Mary, I'm here to tell you. And she said, tell me what? And I recited our conversation about the player who had believed all of her publicity. Well, Mary turned around and walked away without saying anything to me. Then later she came back and said, Wally, I'm sorry, but everybody in the studio is always waiting on you hand and foot, and you get into a rut, and you begin to expect it. But believe me, from now on I'm cured.
Let me stay out late.
for tomorrow is their wedding day. Can't the baby kind of celebrate? Oh, kiss the boys goodbye.
Kiss the Boys Goodbye. Title song from one of the string of films which followed. Most of them something less than inspired, with only momentary flashes of melodic exuberance. The title's almost forgotten now. New York Town, Star Spangled Rhythm, Love Thy Neighbor. Mary feeling that she had not done her best work in any of them. Tired of being typed in sweet, slushy parts, she chucked Hollywood and returned east to work again for Vinton Friedley.
It's unfortunate we have to refer to this one, but we all have our good ones and our bad ones. This was a play by Vernon Duke, music by Vernon Duke, lyrics by Howard Dietz, and a book by an author who shall remain nameless. This play opened in Boston. We went there with great hopes, high hopes. Unfortunately, there was another little opening down the street from us of a play, a musical called Away We Go. We thought it was rather bad booking to open two musicals in Boston on the same night, but we didn't have much respect for this little play because they were only playing to, while they played to capacity, their grosses were modest compared to ours at the Big Schubert Theater where we were selling out nightly. Our play did not receive the accolades we hoped, and although we were a little bit snooty about this other play down the street, we heard it had certain merit. The little play down the street, called Away We Go at that time in Boston, later became Oklahoma, ran 5 years in New York. We played 2 weeks in Boston and closed.
Whatever the defects of the overall production of the big play up the street, Mary filled her role with a buoyant air and challenging enthusiasm. At her best, she was always legitimately exciting. At her worst, she was always completely charming. But stage and movie disappointments could not dull the joy over a relatively brand new girl in the Halliday household, a daughter named Heller, an unusual name. Helen Cahoon agrees.
The reason she liked the name of Heller, which of course, as I said to her, there's no name to it, you see. The word Heller in German means shining, bright. Maybe the child will be, let's hope so. Why do you want to call her Heller? She's Mary Halliday III. Her grandmother and her mother and she are the three Marys. Mary was born 10 or 12 years after the first child was born. And when Mary was born the first year, she cried the enduring time. And Mr. Martin, he'd say, she's just a Heller, you see. Mary thought that was cute, so she named her own child Heller.
And Heller it was in the happy Halliday home, with Dick now Mary's professional manager. The failure of Dancing in the Streets, which had backfired in Back Bay, actually transformed Mary from a mildly successful little movie actress into the musical comedy star of the decade. It made her available for One Touch of Venus, portraying the goddess of love come to life in the vagaries of the American scene. Mary was the mainspring of the piece.
Summer day withers away. Too soon, too soon. Speak love. When you speak love, a moment it twists like ships adrift. We're swept apart too soon.
Bright and entertaining in the lighter vein, the comedy prospered for nearly two dozen Merry Moons in the years 1943 through 45. The vivacious Mary always managing to give the role one touch of Martin. The toast of all Broadway, she literally sparkled. And one night, Oscar Hammerstein sat in the audience.
In the last scene, she came on a little gingham dress. She's just a regular American, corn-fed American girl. And I turned to my wife and I said, this is the kind of part she ought to play. This was not disparaging her portrayal of Venus, because she was great in this. But it seemed to me that this is where she belonged this was really nearer Mary Martin. And I always wanted to write a play for Mary. We were good friends and used to see each other and talk about working together. But it just never bobbed up the right part for her in my plays. So when South Pacific came along, we were both very happy to finally get together on a play.
That special talent for looking and acting like the girl next door, as we now know, would one day be part of the formulae accountable for Mary Martin's greatest success. From a decorative young lady in ermine, who sang My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and a Greek statue come to life in One Touch of Venus, Mary Martin again blithely leapt the centuries, this time in 1946, to be seen and heard as the wistful heroine of a classical Chinese fantasy called Lutsong.
Well, Lutsong was an extremely beautiful production. It was not successful.
John Chapman, veteran theater critic, New York Daily News.
It was a kind of Chinese legend. It had absolutely the most beautiful production in my theater-going knowledge. It was by the late Robert Edmund Jones. And it was a gem of a simply magnificent thing, visually. The sets and the costumes were unearthly in their beauty. The story, I think, was what made the show not as popular as some of the other straight musicals that Mary had been in. It did have one good song, I recall. Mountain High, Valley Low.
If you need me, I will be nearby. Mountain high, valley low. My love follows you until the last. Lightning fast, turtle slow. Journey to the north. Our south winds blow my thoughts to you. If you need me, I will be nearby. Mountain high, valley low.
Lutsong was an artistic success, if not a commercial one. And as it turned out, set the stage for what Mary once described as the biggest hurt in my life.
As a result of Lutsong, Noel Coward had his heart set on getting Mary for a show called Pacific 1860.
Johnny and Marion Byram reflect the poignant reminiscence,
which was to open at the Drury Lane in the winter of 1946. We went to London, and Noel arranged an audition of the show for us. At that time, of course, it was the depths of austerity in England, and you were lucky to get a sandwich at a Lion's shop, you know. And Noel had this quite lovely dinner.
In his charming house.
With very good wines, and after dinner, he played the score.
And sang the lyrics.
And, you know, by the end of the evening, we were all very warm and friendly, and it sounded like a great idea to get. So he called Mary Dick on the transatlantic telephone and said, get over to London as fast as you can. From then on, it was almost a complete disaster. We got to London. The bomb damage at the Drury Lane, which was not extensive but had to be repaired, had not been fixed. So there was a hiatus before they could start rehearsals, and it was during the coldest winter, I suppose, in England's history.
I think they must have suffered.
And, you know, blizzards go. Mary used to come to the theater with red underwear under her costumes, beautiful tropical costumes. And the play wasn't a success. And, you know, it didn't work out terribly well. Noel naturally missed because the play wasn't a success. And as all people are inclined to do, starting blaming somebody, began to blame Mary a little. And he came back to New York and told us one day, he said, I don't think Mary, you know, she's really a vaudeville girl. I don't think she'll ever be beyond song and dance girl, anything really important in theater. And then two or three years later, she did South Pacific. And Noel came back to see her in New York, fell on his knees and kissed her hand and said, Mary, I was wrong. And since then, they've been fast friends.
The story continues in a moment after station identification. As Mary said afterward about the unpleasantness with Noel, it had been a terrible break. She'd write him long letters and reach for the telephone to make it up. but she tore up the letters and never made the calls. By reconciliation time, a good many things had happened en route. Annie, get your gun, for instance.
The night it opened in New Haven, Dick Halliday saw it and said that's the part for Mary.
Producer-director Josh Logan.
And Mary saw it later and decided it was for her, too. And she did a very brave thing. She decided that she wanted to play that part so much that she would take it on tour and play the National Company, even though she was as big a star in those days, and of course still is, as Ethel Merman. And the idea of following a big star in a secondary part had never been done by any very big star before. And Mary has always got that kind of bravery and courage that and nerve to do something that is different. And so everyone said, oh, but Mary, you're too much of a lady. You're too delicate. You can't make enough noise to play this part. And she said, I can't. And she took her hair down and messed it up and bellowed louder than Ethel Merman ever bellowed in her life. And so convinced everyone in this room that Edna Ferber was the one, I think, who had doubted her ability. And just suddenly, Mary had the part.
The Martin name on the marquee of the Hanna Theater in Cleveland or the Harris in Chicago now meant box office. Applause rolled through a dozen cities. The road tour triumphant under the banner of Rogers, Hammerstein, and Martin. Mary was in San Francisco with one more week of Annie to go when...
We called her up in San Francisco, and this was for South Pacific, and...
Again, Oscar Hammerstein.
We told her that we were going to engage Pinza to sing the part of Emil Debeck, and we'd like her to play opposite him, and she said, why do you want two basses? She had reservations about the part, and when she came to New York, I had a long talk with her and pointed out to her that one of the tests of a good part is whether the character changes during the course of the performance, whether the story of the play makes this particular character change in any way. And this character certainly did and developed and changed. She was not the same girl as she was when the curtain rose. We played a few songs for her, and we read the first scene to her, and she fell.
Nellie Forbush was born. The fresh and spirited Navy nurse stationed with American GIs on a little Pacific isle in World War II. The story, a believable and attractive romance between an island planter, an expatriated Frenchman of middle age, and corn-fed, lovable Nellie from Arkansas. Audiences wildly applauded the most talked-about hair wash in history.
I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair and send him on his way. I'm gonna wave that man right out of my arms. I'm gonna wave that man right out of my arms. I'm gonna wave that man right out of my arms and send him on his way.
For 3 years, on stage, Mary Martin triumphantly washed that man right out of her hair to the tune of almost 2,300 shampoos. Knucklehead Nellie went to the hearts of Main Street folk everywhere who make up the vast majority of Broadway audiences. And crop-haired Mary delighted fellow professionals, too.
Just about the greatest evening that we had was our first Sunday night show.
Myron McCormick. He also starred in South Pacific.
Which was not an Actors Fund benefit, actually. And they arranged to give a Sunday night show and make available to every actor who was in the show in New York, playing at the time, a pair of seats. So that this really, truly was an acting event for us and a great event for the audience because it was an actor's audience. Of course, it can be a terrible audience if they don't like the show. But if they like it, they like it good, you know. They respond. And this was a real electric thing. It was like a love affair. The audience was in love with the show, and the show was in love with the audience. And at the end of the performance, it was so really thrilling all the way through the show that as we took our final curtain call, Mary just spontaneously applauded the audience, and of course the rest of the cast joined in. I've never had anything quite as exciting as that night was.
...1,300 enchanted evenings were to come. The indefatigable Mary singing six numbers and being off stage only about 20 minutes during the entire 2.5-hour performance. And one of those evenings, enchanted for a small white-haired gentleman with goatee and sparkling eyes. He came all the way from La Crosse, Wisconsin by bus, and on the very morning of his arrival got in line for standing room tickets before dawn. Victor Bushman, a master printer, then 83 years old, still talks about it.
You had to get there in the morning about 6 o'clock because there were only about 60 standing room tickets sold for the night, and you could only buy one. So I got up early enough to get there to get the first throw at the box office. So at 10 o'clock, I had bought my ticket, and then at night, I went back and stood along the aisle to see the show. When the show opened up, I stood there during the whole performance from the start to the finish. It never fazed me or anything, didn't bother me or anything, but I got an awful good view of the performance, and I enjoyed it very much. And the minute the show was over, the usher and a newspaper lady come along and says, Mary Martin has sent word out that she wants to have you come back to her dressing room. She wants to meet you. So I went back and met Mary Martin. And I want to say this. I met one of the most pleasant ladies of the stage, I believe, that I ever thought I could meet. And she certainly wanted to know how I could stand up in the morning 4 hours and come back at night and stand up another 3 hours without being done up for the rest of the week.
On Mary Martin's final enchanted evening with South Pacific in New York, her personal closing night, though the show was to go on, there was an electric charge which grew more intense as the final curtain approached. Unlike other closing nights on Broadway, this one was to take on an emotional antic and festive turn, like New Year's Eve or Election Day.
Mary's closing night in South Pacific was one of the most heartwarming tributes I've ever seen to a star.
Rady Harris was there.
Because I think the entire cast of a play is reflected, the star rather reflects the morale of the entire company. And Mary never let down in 4 years of playing. I mean, she never sloughed off. Every night was an opening night. And the whole company kept up for that very reason. And there were no backstage feuds or anything. And they all absolutely adored Mary. And closing night, it was so wonderful. There was a party on stage. And the wardrobe mistress and the electricians and every one of the crew had saved. And all of them gave Mary little mementos of their love and affection.
Myron McCormick.
They knew, of course, that it was her last performance. And the cast did, too. You try to play the show, of course, just the same as you always have. But there's nevertheless that undercurrent of feeling that probably is contagious and conveys itself to the audience as well, and from the audience to the cast. You know, that this is the last one of a great thing. And there's an emotional underlying quality that is there, whether you everyone is aware of it, I think. And then afterwards, of course, we had a party on the stage with champagne and tears and embraces, and we'll all see one another again. We'll do another one, and so forth.
And Mary's close friend, NBC's Jinx Falkenberg-McCrary, she perhaps recalls it more vividly than all the others.
It was June 2nd, Saturday night. Mary gave this final performance as Nellie Forbush on stage, and, of course, the whole company stood and cheered in the finale, and then Rodgers and Hammerstein Logan and Hayward came out on stage and presented her with the beautiful pearl and diamond and gold bracelet, and Mary cried, and everybody cried. Well, the show was over. We all went backstage. There was a party afterwards on stage that the producers and the cast gave Mary, who was leaving. The party was over. We went to Mary's dressing room. She took her shoes off. She just, as she said, her favorite expression is, let's plop. You know, so she plopped on her dressing lounge for the last time in that dressing room. I said, Mary, I just can't get over you. I mean, I've always been impressed by your vitality and your interest in everything, but on this day, I should think you would have had such a letdown leaving South Pacific, and I should think you would have been so tired. How do you do it? And she said, well, Jinx, I try to remember that I feel God has given me something that I can give on stage, and I give as much of that as I can every performance, every moment of my life.
Not in recent memory had an actress been given such a farewell. With South Pacific, Mary Martin, the really great musical star of the decade, had arrived. And soon, a good many persons an ocean apart had occasion to congratulate themselves and each other on Mary Martin. South Pacific went to London.
Here was the real Mary Martin, whom we were perhaps seeing for the first time.
W. McQueen Pope, noted British theater critic.
She came back to us with the long, beautiful red hair which we'd previously known, cut short, because of that famous scene in that play where she had to wash her head, where she had to wash that man right out of her hair. And I still stand amazed at the idea that people paid £1 a time, quite a lot of money for a theater seat, you know, for the purpose of seeing a lady wash her head on the stage, a time at which no woman looks at her best, but Mary Martin brought him in to do it. Here was a woman filled with vitality, filled with strength, filled with force, that very force which is so badly wanted in a theater. As I watched her, I couldn't help thinking that this was one of the few women that I've seen in many years past who had that great gift which belonged to our old-time music hall performers. That great individuality, that immense power of timing. Her timing was perfection. That power of being able to stand still and just let her own thoughts and sentiments with a little bit of facial expression come right across and tell the audience what was going on in her mind. She could do that. She was at her best, I thought, in that number, which she sang in the real old music hall way, and which almost was an old music hall lift. I'm in love with a wonderful gal.
I'm as corny as Kansas in August. I'm as normal as blueberry pie. No more a smart little girl with no heart. I have found me a wonderful guy. I am in the conventional dither with the conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat when I speak of that wonderful guy. I'm as trite and as gay as a daisy in May, a cliche coming true. I'm bromidic and bright as a moon, happy night pouring light on the dew. I'm as corny as Kansas in August, high as a flag on the 4th of July. If you'll excuse an expression I use, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love with a wonderful guy. And made a cliche coming through. I'm bromidic and bright as the moon, happy night pouring light on the view.
I'm as corny as Kansas in August, high as the flag on the 4th of July.
If you'll excuse
an expression I use. I'm in love.
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 Mary Martin had done it. The audience stood up, they acclaimed her, they flocked and they flocked and they flocked. There was a queue all day and all night at the box office. People would come out during the first half and rebook for another performance, and that's a thing you don't often get in this town. And it was Mary Martin who did it. The first night was a success. The scenes afterwards, after the curtain had fallen, was, well, something you don't often see. Every celebrity in London, ambassadors, down to small part actors and actresses and television stars, were flocking round their dressing room. It was the best part of 2.5 hours before we got rid of them. And Mary Martin had done that. I class her as one of the best performers in her own kind of line that ever I've seen. And I hope that one day we shall have her back.
Turn your head, but you will not forget the face. Eyes of complimentary brown, wide apart. The first thing you notice when you meet her. A figure more boyish than curvaceous, a heart-shaped face, and probably the only 5'4" girl from Texas you'll ever see. Mary Martin garnered a scrapbook full of all the superlatives in her next venture. Some call it her greatest personal hit, Peter Pan. Originally produced in London more than a half a century ago, first nighters in 1954 wondered if they had grown too old for it, or it too old for them. But Broadway audiences, and later millions of others who watched television, sat wet-eyed, touched as others have been down through the decades. For in the end, everything depended on Mary. And Mary, as the boy who would not grow up, was a delight.
You'll have a treasure if you stay there, more precious far than gold. For once you have found your way there, you can never, never grow old. And that's my home where dreams are born and time is never planned. Just think of lovely things and your heart will fly on wings. Forever and never, never, never.
Well, I'm one of the ones who did see Maude Adams in Peter Pan. And although the past is always colored very rosily, and you think that things were better in the old days than they are now, I came to the conclusion, matching my memory of Maude Adams with the presence of Miss Martin, that Miss Martin was the best Peter Pan I've seen. There was more of a youthful, boyish quality to Mary. She was really a real boy. As I recall, Miss Adams always was the lady. She was the great star and so on, and she was this distant lady, and some of that perhaps made her performance a little more distant.
Others agreed with John Chapman. There had never been a more beguiling sprite in Never Never Land. Mary's Peter Pan was the brother of Nellie Forbush, sweeping and gliding with bird-like ease on a wire no thicker than a thread, turning and soaring, creating poetry without speaking a word. The magic of this performance especially reflecting the shining goodness of spirit which Mary Martin possesses. A goodness growing out of a continuing love affair with people and one of the most successful of show business marriages.
They are the perfect balance.
Again, Jinx Falkenberg.
Richard is rather serious, great business head. He was story editor of Paramount Pictures for 10 years. That's when and how they met. And well, he's a wonderful man, and he's the only one that can really control Mary, just to hold her down when it's needed. It is the perfect marriage, the Hallidays.
The home life is something very special because when Mary is at home, that is her whole life. She concentrates on her husband, on her handsome young son, Larry, and on her beautiful young daughter, Heller. And when Mary was on stage in South Pacific and lived in New York City and went from the hotel room to the dressing room at the theater, then went on stage every night and two matinee days a week, she had to concentrate on that. That was her career during the week. The minute Saturday night came, she'd get into the car, walk just off stage into the car, drive home, and Sunday and Sunday night and all day Monday until about 5 o'clock, every second was spent with Heller.
Two lives successfully integrated. Real life beginning where Broadway ends. A heart belonging to both the family and the theater. A remarkably talented and persuasive entertainer.
I mean, I, for instance, believe that Mary Martin could play a villainess.
Once again, Myron McCormick.
But she's that good an actress. And she would be believed. Yeah. She's a very fine actress. She can do things without having to sing. I think people love to hear her sing, but she's not confined to that by any means. Her talent is great in all departments, I think. And, there's no reason in the world why she shouldn't do almost anything she wanted to do.
And again, Rady Harris.
When I first knew Mary, she was living in a theatrical boarding house on Sixth Avenue. Now she has a beautiful home in the country. She has a triplex apartment in New York. She has a coffee plantation in Brazil. In spite of all these superficial changes, basically Mary is still the same unspoiled, sweet, enchanting personality that I met 17 years ago, and no amount of success will ever change her. She doesn't forget old friends, you know. It's a rare quality.
The same offstage as on. The same then as now. A fine comedian, a glorious musical comedy star, a bewitching performer, blessed with personality and the heart of Texas.
Oh, she's such a Texan. You should hear her when she gets around with Texans. Why, she becomes so southern, honey, that you just... I'm not a Texan, but I've heard Mary, and I just... It's amazing. It all comes back. You know, she's a Texan through and through. And they're proud of her, and she's very proud of being a Texan. And you know, in Born Yesterday, as blonde and beautiful, Billy Dawn, who's a little bit dumb, I think... At least that's the way Judy Holliday played it on Broadway and on screen. The girl was from Brooklyn, Billy Dawn. But this Billy Dawn on television that Mary's going to play is from Texas. She's blonde and beautiful and a little dumb, but she's from Texas.
Texan to the core, this Mary Martin, but the pride of us all. Other triumphs now loom on the personal horizon for the slim woman with the Peter Pan face and the coaxing way. Who has charmed presidents and kings, big folk and small, and who will still be packing them in when the professional beauties are long forgotten. Mary Martin, queen of musical comedy.
Good night, wherever you are. May your dreams be pleasant dreams wherever you are.
You've been listening to a transcribed NBC biography in sound, written and edited by Jean Farinet, narrated by Frank Blair. In Meet Mary Martin, you heard Oscar Hammerstein II, Joshua Logan, Vinton Friedley, Jinx Falkenberg, Wally Westmore, Myron McCormick, and others. Biographies in Sound has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.